Access number 29039, Mr. Alan Pollock, Reel 7. Now, what was the purpose of your attachment to HMS Albion? Was this just more experience?
Yes, I think, again, it was the idea was for to give you experience when you're young of the other services, which was, again, I'm not quite certain how I was lucky enough to get on that after being on the other trip down to Kenya. And I can't remember whether I've volunteered as being interested to go down and see the Navy or not. But then the Royal Navy was still a fair size, because a memory that I haven't spoken about but was very significant was to actually see the what was left of the Mediterranean. And it almost was a Grand Fleet leaving Grand Harbour, because it was there were enough sort of destroyers with the two carriers and that to be a most impressive spectacle. And we'd flown down to Lucca again and joined them in Valletta Harbour, and to see the fleet exercising was fascinating. Intriguingly, they were very self-contained then. So, in other words, all the aircraft on those carriers, and we had Avengers, we had the Seahawk squadron. There might have been two Seahawk squadron.
These'd be fleet air arm.
Yeah, all fleet air arm. And I very nearly joined the fleet air arm, because strangely, that was the way I ended up going into the Air Force very quickly after hanging around for a year after my A levels.
So you were attached to the fleet air arm aboard HMS Albion just for this, the experience tour.
That's right, yeah. I think it was only probably 7 or 8 days, I think. But it was intriguing to see a carrier operating and working up and its operations at sea. And, of course, they had Gannets already then.
Do you get any flights?
Not off the carrier, no, and I can't remember whether there's any problem on that or not, and I can't remember being transferred in any way, the choppers, because I think you're quite right, I think the Air Force would have probably wanted to get you airborne straight away, but the Navy, I could be wrong, but for a long time, of course, the fleet air arm were very much almost guests on the Royal Navy's command. But I can remember the sheer size of it too. I mean, it seemed a ginormous thing, and the Albion, of course, was just an average size. I'm wondering even whether it was a fleet carrier. It wasn't far off it, I imagine, but it was probably one stage down from being a fleet carrier. But it was the sheer size and I think it was later that I actually was on a submarine. I don't think it was then.
So then you go back to Cranwell, of course. Now let's just look at your passing out from there. Then what was the passing out parade and
yes, you had a
what was the passing? Tell us about that.
We had the wings parade was the night before your passing out parade, and then at your passing out parade,
so
it was actually filmed.
Was when you got given your wings.
Wings, that's right, and that was done from memory. The commandant did that. The VIP wasn't there. He arrived the following day, and that was Tony. We had Tony Boyle on the entry, and he won the actual sword, won the sword of honour, and his father was the Chief of Air Staff then. That was Dermot Boyle, and he was a very fine bloke. And I met him sort of almost socially by his being Tony's father, and his mother was rather splendid too. And he was one of these great people that could talk to anyone
out.
At any level. Yeah, and he took that passing out parade. And the you're all on parade in your three squadrons. There were only three squadrons then, A squadron, B squadron, and C squadron. And we, by then we were senior entry, so you'd be actually in front of the main three ranks. There'd be three ranks, and then since effectively you were passing out, you would be in front of those. And we didn't have for that passing out parade, you wouldn't have your rifles anymore when you got your wings. And I can remember Dermot Boyle on the inspection actually stopping and having a chat with me, and I think he asked me a question that I wasn't too certain that I gave him an adequate answer, and that was sort of why I had joined the Air Force. And I didn't give him as smart an answer as I'd have liked to, I think. And then one marched off the parade square after the parade through into the college. And by the time you were in the college, the theory was that you were then commission status. And then we were so fortunate. Well, I didn't mention that. I mean, that evening, of course, would be the graduation ball. And I can remember Hugh's sister, I'm sure, was up there, Diana Riggs. She was either there or the previous graduation. And each penultimate entry, in other words, the entry that was going to become the senior entry after the entry had, that particular entry had passed out, would actually organise the ball. So we'd have done that previously for 66 entry, which was a small entry, and each third entry thought they were a bit more special. Whether that was right or wrong, it was just really to do with the end of the school year, I think, because they tended to be slightly bigger entries, every third entry. And you know, there were three per year, and you had junior entries at that stage for 6 months, and then 2 years your basic training flying and your advanced flying year. And then we went off to 8 FTS, I think it was, at Swinderby.
And that was in, well, you packed the ball, was it, you had a bit of leave or something. So April
56, that's right, just a few days.
Cranwell.
Yeah.
And then eight, now what, that's number eight flying
training. I think I went up to Scotland, I think, straight away after that, but just because of I had the motorcycle.
Now, what do you remember of your time at number eight flying training school? What was the setup of the school? And why were you there, in a way?
We were there, really, to complete our conversion to jet aircraft. And again, we're very, very fortunate, because that meant we had some extra flying there to complete our wings. I think it was I've got a list here. We've got 235 hours at Cranwell total, 235 hours flying, and that was those five marks of four types: the Chipmunk, the Provost, the Balliol, and the Vampire, T11 and the FB9. And obviously pretty small amount, there's only 32 hours flying there, which was Vampire and jet. And then we went on to do this extra flying at Swinderby, which was really rather splendid, because you were just doing flying and precious little else there, and it really felt extremely pleasant for a change.
And what aeroplanes were you flying there?
Well, that was, again, the Vampire, and instead of the nine, we had the fives there. We had now five, Vampire fives, and that was virtually the same as the nine, but it was, you know, there was virtually very little difference, apart from that electric loading that had caused me the trouble in the nine at Cranwell.
Now, what was the other aircraft you flew there, or was it just that one?
No, that was it. Just the Vampire T-11, and that was Morford. And it was really just to complete your conversion onto the jet aircraft before you went to OCU to give us more flying. And then...
Now, you were there about 5 months. Anything happened, or is this just...
Oh, yes, I can remember vividly the rather sad incident when an Iraqi came in and whether there was something wrong with his controls, or I think it was a combination of things, sadly, and that was pretty certain that was in a Vampire 5.
And what happened? For some reason,
I don't know why we were outside, maybe because sometimes you get an alert of something happening, and I can just remember vividly seeing this aircraft climbing at an extraordinary angle that was obviously quite unsustainable for an aircraft to be climbing at that angle without instant doom. And he then sort of flicked in and down onto the airfield, and then we watched, not that it made the slightest bit of difference, but the vivid memory I have is of watching the fire vehicles trundle out there and roll out as quickly as they could, their apparatus, and then absolutely nothing happened for some reason. You know, it was just didn't come out in terms of a flow of foam or anything like that, or water. It was just something went wrong with it. Not that it mattered at all, because it was obviously total. You know, the bloke had no chance at all, this Iraqi guy.
What had he done wrong? What had gone wrong with the aircraft?
Well, to be quite honest, I've only got the vaguest of memory about whether we actually did find out what had happened. Whether there had been some sort of control problem, or whether he'd climbed away too steeply, or a combination of both. I've no idea. But, I mean, it was... Because I didn't mention that... And it all seemed routine in those days. I mean, fatalities didn't fuss you too much, because they almost were routine. Just when I'd immediately before my first solo, and immediately after, I was on funeral drill, and there was a certain normality about it in those days. And as I mentioned, until we got the ejection seats in, you know, you did expect fatalities. It was something that happened, and you'll know there were quite a lot on the Meteor OCUs as well, and even out on the squadrons. But the ejection seats certainly did have a tremendous help on that front in terms of reducing the fatalities.
Now, anything else you did there that you remember at Swinderby?
Well, we did more advanced formation flying, and...
Now, we haven't mentioned formation flying. Is this where you started doing it properly, or...?
Yeah, well, we'd have done quite a lot of formation on the earlier aircraft. I say a lot, that's probably wrong. We'd have learned the basics of formation flying.
Now, what are the basics of formation? What are the skills and...
Well, you have to normally go up, fighters have to go up through cloud together, and come down often together through cloud and bad weather, and land together, because it's the fastest way of getting fighters up and down in all types of weather. And it's something that you practice, that aspect, although obviously if the weather's quite all right, you immediately go out into what's called battle formation, and immediately you get your wheels up, you go out into a wide formation where you're covering each other's tail, and you're normally operating then as a 4 or a 2 or an 8. But you have to learn how to formate.
Now, how do
very
you
quickly
formate?
Well, there are you just line up certain to get yourself a constant position just a few feet out from the other guy's wingtip. You probably normally have about 5 or 6 or 7 feet gap between his wingtip and your wingtip, and you're step back slightly if you're in the number 2 position, which is on the right hand side, or in the number 3 position, which is on the left side, and number 4 is in the box. That's the fourth one at the back of the diamond, so to speak. And he's slightly low. He's below the jet pipe or the wash of the leader. And you just practice those three positions, really. The number 2 position out on the right, the number 3 position out on the left, and the number 4 position where you're in close line astern. And the close line astern one is probably the most easy one to fly. And, you really just have to be using your throttle and your coordination so that you're sticking exactly in that position and you're just flying as a four or as a two, whatever the leader's smoothly doing.
Was it difficult or was it something that came...
I think some people found it difficult, but it was also very exhilarating. You probably know that, and it was a very good exercise. It was a very satisfying thing to do, slightly tiring, as with low-level formation aerobatics. Can leave people very tired but very satisfied because you know, you're working very hard, very intensely, and normally at low level you're often you know, that you're rarely being cooled well enough. You often get quite hot and sticky at low level doing that. But learning the rudiments, the sort of initial rudimentary elements of formation flying is really something that you feel you're really leaping forward. When you do low-level navigation, formation flying, and maybe advanced instrument flying, you really feel that then you're developing. And at that stage, if you're instructing the other way around, if you're on the instruction, you then see who are the ones that are really going to be good.
Now, what about, have you done any firing of any sort at this stage?
No, that came...
This is just
firing. Firing then. You're quite right in a funny way that... Back on the Harvard stage, they did used to do a certain amount of limited firing at the tail end of their, certainly when they learned to be instructors, and I think even as students occasionally, they did some of that in the syllabus. No, but beyond the Harvard, we didn't do that at all, and that was kept entirely to the OCU level.
Now, anything else about Swinderby then? Or should we move to...
No.
So the next thing is, you're there 5 months, and then the next thing is you go to number 233 Operational Conversion Unit.
That's right. That was down at Pembrey.
In South... Is that Glamorgan?
We were split... No, Pembrey's Carmarthenshire. And the sad thing about Pembrey, on the downside, was it then was slightly... It had the worst weather factor of any station in Fighter Command. So its weather there to this day, you know, around that area in Carmarthen, tends to be raining. And you've got the Pembrey actually refers to the Penny Brint, which is the hills to the north of it. But Pembrey is still open as a range to this day. And you've probably heard of Pembrey Sands, where they used to do the racing. Pendine Sands was very close to Pembrey, where they did the... motorcycle speed racing and that on the hard sands.
Now, what was your impression? You got there in what, October, and how did they start? This is your operational conversion flying.
That's right. That was split. First of all, people either went to Chivner, which was on the north Devon coast in an inlet near Barnstaple, or Pembrey. And Pembrey really are. I think, from chatting to the others, although the weather factor was probably poorer there, I think it was a far more friendly station then. But Chivner was always a popular place, so, you know, it's slightly strange what I'm saying, but I thought we got I thought it was a very friendly place. The locals too around there, the Welsh, I thought were splendid people, just in Carmarthen and Llanelli. Llanelli was the closest town.
Now, what happened when you first arrived there then? How did they start you on this conversion program?
It was split, really. And it was really teaching you to do battle formation and everything to do with what you needed on a fighter squadron. But that was on vampires. So in other words, it was a two-stage. It was the vampire stage and then... it was the hunter conversion after that.
So this is the vampire FB5.
Again, it was the 11. It was 11 for being taught to fire, and just a checkout, you know, for the local what they called the sector recce, where you just every time you went to a new station, you just used to go off to look around the local area to get to know what it looked like from the air, and then. You did a planned sorties normally in the single seat.
We're running ahead. What did you do first when you got there?
Well, the first one, you'd probably just have a dual checkout. It's a kind of acceptance. Yes. And then quite quickly, you'd be taken on through their syllabus, the operational. It was an operational conversion unit, so you're basically being shown and practicing anything and everything to do with operational flying. But that was largely there to teach you later how to fire the guns and earlier how to do battle formation.
So how did at they altitude. Teach you? So they taught you to do battle formation at altitude in the Vampire.
Yes.
Now, what do you remember of that? What is battle formation?
Well, battle formation is really the way that that fighters look after themselves, and when they go hunting for other fighters, it's really an attack, both a defensive and an attack formation, where you have normally four aircraft, but you can have two sections of four, which make an eight, and you could even have 16, but you tended to have, very rarely would you have 16 hunters up. In the Vampire days, you'd be more likely to have that with slightly higher serviceability ratios on the Vampires in terms of what we call wingdings, but it was really to learn the elements, which was really your duties within a four. A four ship was the standard.
So what are your duties within a four?
Well, your leader would actually give you the brief, and you'd have two sections or subsections of that four. The whole lot would be called green section, maybe, or red section, or black section, or whatever it was. And mission numbers, I think, were just about to come in then. Maybe they hadn't come, but within a few months, mission numbers came in as well to identify people. But at that stage, you were red, yellow, green, just coloured, used colours for the sections. And you'd learn effectively the fundamentals of being a number two.
So what's
and
the,
that was really
not number
being,
one then?
No. But you would lead as pairs leaders, because you'd go off on certain sorties with another student, and you'd already be leading then, but him as a pair.
So, but you would never do a four?
No.
So what's the duties of a number two?
Well, the number two really was to stick with his leader and for mate after takeoff. And if the weather was clear, you'd go straight out into battle formation, where you'd be covering each other. And there was a different type of battle formation at low level, because if you were flying at low level, you'd be more in an arrowhead formation, where the leader was further forward, and the number two and the number three, who was the deputy leader, the number three, and the four, who'd be covering the number three's tail, and the rest of the section would be more swept back at low level. But in those days, a lot of our work was still at high level. So it was practicing high level battle turns, where it's quite difficult to describe, but four aircraft, if they have to turn through 90 or 45 degrees, you had to learn exactly where that aircraft had to go to cover the tails as you were turning through, as I say, 45 degrees or 90 degrees or turnabouts going all the way around. And it was really learning the rudiments of that initially on the Vampire. And then the part of, I was lucky then to go on onto Hunters.
Anything else you did? So is it just and then not firing?
Firing the guns as well.
On the Vampire?
Yes.
So tell us about that.
But because I had a heavy cold at the end, I did not end up actually firing solo. And that led to a slightly interesting incident when I was out later on the squadron. But normally people fired at a flag. Yeah, we were already firing at a flag, but I don't think we did firing on the ground, but we certainly did air to ground later. I don't think we did air to ground there, intriguingly. I can remember doing air to ground far more when later in the
so what did you do?
In the Hunter in Germany, but we did against aerial towed targets, towed by meteors, yeah, and they'd be flags at the back of meteors, and you'd learn again, which I haven't talked about, but when we're speaking about advanced formation flying, the transition from advanced formation flying into combat flying is tail chasing, and I haven't mentioned tail chasing, but tail chasing was probably one of the things you're doing quite a lot at an operation conversion unit.
And
that is where you're behind each other, and you've just got to stick and stay behind somebody. And if you're number three or number four, you're obviously in that position. Whatever the guy at the front does, and he tries to shake you off, and you know you've got to use your air brakes or push out to stay wide so that you don't overtake him, because obviously, and that's a very good exercise, because if you overtake someone, you're obviously very vulnerable, and you've got to learn to stay with someone, whatever they do.
Now, what about the firing at drugs? What were you firing? I mean, what weapons did the
Oh, sorry, we got 20mm Brownings in the vampires, and
had you not been taught deflection shooting or
anything? Yes,
like that?
Yeah, and
when did that
too, and
well, that happened
we had
there.
Yes, and also you started really learning all about the fixed ring and what aircraft looked like in how you had to deflection shooting was.
Now
that's
tell
what
me
it's
about,
all about
deflection shooting and the fixed ring. You mean the ring side?
Yeah, we had a fixed ring with a circle around it, and the gun sight was a fixed gun sight until no, I'm sorry. On the T11, it also came up. You had a Mark 5 or a Mark 8 sight later on the Hunter, but the Mark 5 came up and down, and that was the same from memory on the Vampire. So it would come up towards your face, and the you adjusted the wingspan of whatever you're attacking, and it was nice and easy with the Hunter. You remember it was 34 feet, and amazingly the tail of a Victor, if you're attacking a Victor, was exactly the same, 34 feet. It would be the same as the full span of a Hunter's wing, or 99 feet for the first Vulcan ones. And you'd learn these by heart, and you'd just flick it round as you were beginning to attack, and that would give you really your pippers that you had. And then you'd be practicing
pippers
with your ranging. They would bring down the diamonds on either side. You'd be moving your twist grip on your throttle, and that would give you the ranging of how much deflection and where you should be aiming your guns, flying your aircraft. And in exactly the same way, you learn deflection shooting on the flag, with firing at about 230 yards, something like that, down to maybe 190.
The flag is a drogue, isn't it?
That's right, the flag, the banner. Yeah, and I can remember there, what was my big memory of being down there while still on the Vampires was that the whole Suez thing had just started, and probably not the most politically correct thing, but we were, bearing in mind we were being taught to hit the thing, I can remember the thing that was said was the banner is made of Egyptian cotton, hate it and hit it, was a slightly non-PC thing that was going round there because of the troubles with the Suez, which was just starting at that stage.
And you could hit it.
Oh yes, and you could see you fired, each people fired different colours on the banner. You know, there was red and brown tended to look a bit like each other, and yellow, green and blue. And as I said, I never saw a flag before I went out to Germany, partly because of my cold, and that led to a slightly funny incident, which
we'll
I'll talk about